You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and now it's time for a science news update. Joining us is regular Pulse contributor Carrie Grenz. She's an associate editor for The Scientist, and in that role, she reads through lots and lots of studies every week and keeps us posted on the latest. Her picks for this week are flying dinosaurs, genetic pacemakers, and lab safety. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Mike.
Carrie, let's start with the flying dinos.
Yes. For a long time, it's been thought that dinosaurs didn't fly. Even though it's widely believed that birds descended from dinosaurs, flight is thought to be an invention that birds came up with. This week, scientists reported that a new dinosaur species identified from a fossil in China was completely covered in feathers. Now, this is not the first feathered dinosaur to be dug up, but it's definitely the largest. It was 4 feet long, and it had big teeth and sharp claws. So one of the big questions about this animal now is whether it actually flew like a bird. It's possible that it just glided more like a flying squirrel.
Or maybe it just had feathers.
Right, or maybe it just had feathers. That's entirely possible.
So the other kind of flying creatures that my kids have in various gummy forms are not dinosaurs, like the pteranodons?
Right, those were not dinosaurs. They lived at the time of the dinosaurs, but they are a different branch.
What does this new finding of this potentially flying dinosaur mean?
Well, they think it might represent the earlier part of the evolution of flight, you know, that perhaps it wasn't an invention of the birds, but came earlier. And it might help understand how flight came to be, you know, what was required of the body plan design and the feathers and the bones and things like that to enable animals to take flight.
Carrie, let's move on to our second topic, genetic pacemakers. What is that?
So instead of an electronic pacemaker that you would have implanted into your heart, what scientists are reporting this week that they have done is they've developed a cellular pacemaker. They've made the body, or at least the body of a pig, make its own pacemaker cells. So our hearts already have their own pacemaker cells, but for some people who have slow cardiac rhythms, they benefit from an implanted pacemaker to keep it at the right pace. So this latest study that came out this week, researchers injected pig hearts with a gene that converts their heart muscle cells into these pacemaker cells. These pigs all had a heart condition, and the scientists found that these pacemaker cells did their job. They kept the heart rate up, and these pigs were less dependent on a pacemaker implant.
What's the potential of this? Could be pretty big.
Absolutely. I think what the researchers originally thought was that this could perhaps be a bridge therapy for people who have to have their pacemaker removed. Say if they got an infection, you might have to take it out for a couple weeks, let the tissue heal, take some antibiotics, and that maybe you could have this gene therapy work. Because in this case, the experiment was just 2 weeks long. So this isn't thought that it's necessarily a permanent treatment, but perhaps it could be just a temporary bridge while you're having the pacemaker removed.
Carrie, we also want to talk to you today about hazardous biomaterial transfers. We've heard a lot of kind of scary news about that.
Right. There have been a number of news reports coming out in recent days and weeks. So some of the big news that broke last week is that smallpox vials dating back to the 1950s were found in a storage closet in a lab at the FDA. Nobody knows what they were doing there. And, you know, it's disturbing that there was no knowledge of their presence. Then the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported last Friday that a dangerous strain of bird flu was accidentally shipped to the USDA. All of this comes on the heels of an anthrax snafu back in June, where dozens of government workers could have been exposed. So the picture that's beginning to emerge now is that there seems to be a kind of culture of lax biosecurity, maybe not in every lab at the CDC, but enough to cause these multiple incidents. So this week, a House committee released a report from the USDA that looked at some of the problems at the CDC and found that the CDC was storing anthrax in unlocked refrigerators with no signs on them. People were shipping things in Ziploc bags. Disinfectants had expired. So now the attention is turning to, you know, how did this happen and how can we clean up these labs that handle dangerous materials?
What kind of security measures are typically in place with a lab that handles potentially dangerous materials?
There are different levels of biosecurity. So at the strictest, you might have a secured facility that's locked that only certain personnel have clearance to enter. They may have to don a Tyvek jumpsuit and shower upon leaving. I think that the reason why there's so much attention on the CDC is that it handles these very, very dangerous materials. Smallpox, for instance, the World Health Organization only sanctions two places in the world to store smallpox, one of which is the CDC. So they're handling things that are potentially much more dangerous than your run-of-the-mill, you know, infectious disease lab. And there's kind of, you know, sort of a flurry of activity, especially at the CDC now. The agency put a moratorium on shipping biological materials from its topmost biosecurity facilities. So they're taking some security precautions right now to figure out where these weaknesses are in the safety protocols.
Kerry Grenz, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Megan.
Kerry Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist, and she joins us regularly on The Pulse to keep us updated on the latest science news.